Well, good morning. I don't know how many of you managed to come over to hear me last night. It was a very basic talk. I was told to speak to a broad audience, and I could tell from the audience that it looked like it was mainly retired people from the Santa Barbara area who were looking for amusement, and I hope I succeeded in amusing them. But my directions for this morning were a little different. First, I was told to prepare for constant interruptions. That'd be great. It's fine. I'm happy to be interrupted with questions or criticisms. That would be even better. But what I'm basically going to do is go through a research seminar, one that I have been giving lately, on two subjects related to how cells, and now I'm going to focus exclusively on mammalian cells, how mammalian cells handle unusual cargo molecules. Rather than the standard soluble proteins or membrane proteins that are conveyed from station to station within the secretory pathway, metazoans, unlike yeast, have evolved procedures to handle either very large particles or, as you'll see initially, very large complexes that cannot normally be accommodated by the vesicles that convey cargo molecules from organelle to organelle. The first that we'll encounter is how cells handle collagen. Collagen, as you'll see, is made as a triple helical rigid rod of about 300 nanometers in diameter, and that is much larger than a typical coated vesicle that conveys material through the secretory pathway. But cells have, of course, evolved a way to deal with this, and we've been exploring the mechanism of that process in recent years, and I'll tell you about an update on that. Then I'm actually going to spend most of my time talking about a brand new project that we've just written up and hope to submit shortly on how mammalian cells secrete small RNA. It turns out that small RNAs are packaged into vesicles, which themselves are expelled from cells. I'll tell you how people think about that. And then I'm going to focus on a brand new project started by a brilliant graduate student of mine that has allowed us to investigate the biochemical mechanism of sorting of small, specifically microRNAs, that are packaged into vesicles for export, and what that may mean, what functional implications that may have for intercellular communication, and how it apparently may be subverted in metastasis of cancer cells from a primary tumor. So a lot of different things, I think, I hope, a lot of opportunity for discussion. Okay, so let's begin. I thought it would be best to begin with a summary of a great deal of work that was done in my lab over the last, I'm embarrassed to say, 20 years, on how secretory and membrane proteins are packaged into a transport vesicle. This work all began with yeast, using the mutants that I described last night, but more specifically using a biochemical assay that another brilliant student of mine by the name of David Baker some years ago developed to allow us to study the biochemical mechanism of traffic. Initially through Baker and then through many other people in the lab, we discovered the pathway of formation of a transport vesicle that we call a COP2 vesicle. It begins on the surface of the ER membrane with a membrane protein called SEC12, one of the original SEC genes. SEC12, we found decades ago, encodes an integral membrane protein, the cytoplasmic N-terminal domain of which is a nucleotide exchange catalyst that operates on a small GTP binding protein called SAR1. SAR1 is a soluble cytoplasmic protein in the dormant GDP form. It is perfectly water-soluble, but it encounters, by interaction, transient interaction, the exchange catalyst SEC12, and that causes SAR1 to extend an amphipathic N-terminal helical domain that allows the GTP activated form of SAR1 to embed locally into the adjacent membrane, where that interaction alone begins to buckle the membrane to create a small bud. Eventually, if you just do this with pure protein and artificial vesicles, it will generate large tubules that emanate from a liposome. But in the local circumstance, we believe it just begins this process. Then a heterodimer of two proteins called SEC23/24 is recruited. We know that SEC24, this subunit, has multiple independent binding pockets that recognize different sorting signals, specifically on membrane cargo proteins. And these signals are decoded by one or another of the binding pockets on SEC24. The cargo molecule then engages non-covalently. This cargo molecule may also be a receptor to allow cargo completely within the lumen of the ER secretory proteins to be gathered in, again, in complex indirectly with the coat. This cluster of cargo and partial coat, we believe, diffuses within the plane of the membrane, where it encounters a scaffold complex called SEC1331 that has the ability to self-assemble into a polyhedral structure that seems to be the physical principle that shapes a normal transport vesicle. And that will become important for the discussion that we'll have in the next few minutes.
Randy, can I ask a question?
Of course, of course.
SAR1, does this association with the membrane happen everywhere in the ER or in just a certain region of the ER?
Yeah, that's a good question. We think it probably could happen anywhere because you can reconstitute this on the surface of a synthetic liposome with no special membrane proteins. And if you reconstitute a proteoliposome with SEC12 bound, you can recruit SAR1 to virtually anywhere on that surface. Now, in the cell, in the ER membrane, SEC12 is itself clustered in domains, particularly in mammalian cells, corresponding to what's called the ER exit site, which is a restricted domain that may self-assemble because of SEC12 interaction with other proteins. And so SAR1 would then be restricted to that domain simply by virtue of where it encounters SEC12. But by itself, I'm not sure that SAR1 has any specificity for anything else.
I have another question, which is this phenomenon that tubules form when you have the SEC23/24. Why doesn't the membrane, let's say, just shed a bunch of vesicles?
Yeah.
You could still have the same curvature vesicle form as in tubule form.
Yeah. It tends not to, because we think it's the scaffold complex of SEC1331 that really promotes fission by the formation of this polymer that eventually closes on itself and pinches the membranes to very close apposition at the other end. That seems, by the way, to require SAR1 GTP. And it may even require SAR1 GTP hydrolysis, because if you assemble the entire set of components on a synthetic liposome, on the GUV, you make long, multi-lobed tubules that fail efficiently to complete the fission reaction. And by the way, I should have said we do this when you include a non-hydrolyzable analog of GTP in the incubation. And we've actually never really succeeded in reconstituting the normal fission reaction with GTP and all the set of proteins. It just hangs up there. So we may be missing something. But the fission reaction, we think, normally requires the complete polymerization of the coat, including the scaffold. Anything else? Yes?
And
maybe people could identify yourselves as you ask questions.
I'm Shelley Sazer.
Oh, yes, Shelley.
And the addition of the SEC1331, mm-hmm. the trigger effect that it only assembles when there's a certain
It doesn't. Not with a measurable affinity. So it may require clustering of the inner layer of the coat. In fact, we've seen, in artificial reactions, at a sufficiently high concentration of 23-24, you form a kind of an almost crystalline array on the surface of a membrane. And it may cluster through lateral interactions, weak lateral interactions. We haven't really explored that. That's a good point. Well, anyway, so we've been investigating this for many years in yeast and then in mammalian cells. The biochemical reaction that we used to identify and purify functional forms of these proteins in yeast works perfectly well with lysates of mammalian cells. But I was aware many years ago of, sort of problems with this, and it's particularly in dealing with very large particles, because a normal COP2 vesicle is maybe 80 nanometers in diameter, and yet, as I indicated, collagen is very large. There are giant lipoproteins that use COP2. There's something in the intestinal epithelium called a chylomicron, which is the first place where fatty acids are incorporated into lipoproteins. Those things can grow to a half a micron in diameter. And yet, they use COP2 because, as I mentioned very briefly last night, there's a human disease where one of the two paralogs of SAR1 is deficient. There are two copies of SAR1, so-called SAR1B, which is highly expressed in the intestinal epithelium. There are patients with a disease called Anderson's disease with defects in that protein, and these patients are otherwise normal, but they have a hell of a time secreting chylomicron. So in their intestine, in enterocytes of the intestine, the chylomicrons get made, and they just pile up in the ER. So these patients have to deal with fats in their diet, but they can otherwise be controlled. So we considered, of course, whether collagen also depended upon COP2. One could always invoke some other pathway. But it turns out collagen clearly does require COP2. And one reason is this a disease that I briefly mentioned last night, a craniofacial disorder that turned up in a Bedouin population in Saudi Arabia, a defect in SEC23, one of the two paralogs of SEC23. Skin cells cultured from these patients, from homozygous patients, produce giant bloated ER tubules. And in this image, which I didn't show last night, we've looked at the disposition of collagen, specifically a procollagen, in normal fibroblasts, the leading edge, shown here labeled with an antibody against a luminal protein. PDI shows this reticulum extending to the leading edge of the cell, populated completely overlapping with collagen as seen by an indirect immunofluorescence with an antibody that recognizes procollagen. And in fibroblasts from the patients, one sees the leading edge now containing huge bloated ER vacuoles, also labeled with PDI, but similarly labeled with procollagen. And we can actually show that that collagen has a specific problem getting out of these cells. So we struggled for some years to come up with some way, preferably some biochemical way, of understanding how the COP2 pathway could be altered, how the polymerization of the coat could be altered to create a shallow curvature that would accommodate a large particle. And we got nowhere. And then one day, a few years ago, I was giving a seminar at Vanderbilt. And my host was taking me through the campus in the morning. And I saw this amazing sculpture, which suggested someone else was pondering the very same problem. This clearly, the artist had in mind the problem of how a polyhedral structure could envelop a rigid rod like procollagen. So if we never figure this out, maybe I'll go back and find the artist and see what she had in mind. Yeah. But fate intervened after my visit to Vanderbilt, quite unconnected to it, in the form of a wonderful collaboration with a young colleague of mine. Well, he used to be young. Now he's sort of middle-aged. His name is Michael Rapa. And Rapa had a graduate student in the lab, Lingyan Jin, who was studying the role of a particular ubiquitin ligase, the Cullen 3 ubiquitin ligase. So there are hundreds, possibly thousands, of different ubiquitin targets in mammalian cells, and a corresponding large repertoire of different enzymes that seek out, recognize, and modify targets, many of which are fated for degradation, others of which are diverted to other pathways through ubiquitination. And Rapa has made a career of studying the mechanism and specificity of ubiquitin conjugation. And Lingyan was studying mouse embryonic stem cells and asked whether this particular family, the Cullen 3 family, had anything to do with maintenance of the undifferentiated state or the transition to differentiation in the ES cell line. She found that when she ablated the major subunit of the Cullen 3 ligase, that mouse ES cells rounded up and were no longer maintained in an undifferentiated state. She eventually attributed this to some defect in the elaboration or maintenance of the extracellular matrix that allows these cells to grow and to form an adherent colony and be maintained in an undifferentiated state. She then, the Cullen E3 ligase achieves specificity by invoking one of over 200 different specificity subunits that share a common sequence element called the BTB domain. So there are over 200 BTB domain-containing proteins, each one of which assembles into a Cullen E3 ligase complex. And when it interacts, when one interacts, the complex then seeks out and ubiquitinates a particular target. So her initial experiments were done with the core subunit of this complex. So she wanted to find out which of the specific BTB domaining proteins was responsible for this rounding up and loss of adhesion of mouse ES cells. Again, this is so far removed from what we were doing, I wasn't even aware she was doing this. But then she found that one particular subunit, happens to be called KLHL12, was responsible, and she did several experiments that gave amazing results that became very interesting to us. The first experiment that she did was she took this BTB domain-containing protein, and she just expressed it in a surrogate cell line, a HeLa cell line, to just see if she could find what the target of ubiquitination was. And she found that the target was SEC31, the large subunit of the outer shell of the COP2 coat. Quite specifically, SEC31. She then looked in the cells, the surrogate transfected cells, to see what she could see, where this protein hung out, whether it hung out in association with SEC31. And she found, as you'll see in the next slide, in which we published a couple of years ago, that in cells overexpressing this KLHL12 protein, the cells produced giant COP2 vesicles. So here is an experiment where KLHL12 is indirectly labeled, and one sees particles that are, in this case, about a half a micron in diameter, but they can grow to over 2 microns in diameter. Often they're ring-shaped, quite interestingly. But most importantly, the label coincides with different subunits of the COP2 coat, such that on merge, you can see these giant ring-shaped structures where KLHL12 and several of the subunits of the COP2 coat coincide. Yes?
So there are fewer of them?
Yes, many fewer. The normal COP2 puncti, if you just label with SEC31, they're pretty small, no more than 100 nanometers in diameter, and profuse. They're all over, they're all over what would be considered the ER exit face. But they clearly coalesce into many fewer puncti. You'll see examples later on as we look more closely at this. Many fewer giant puncti. So this, of course, was very exciting to my lab. And we began a collaboration with Misha and Lingyan, where we asked whether we could show that this effect influence the rate of secretion of collagen, to try to really link their observation to the question at hand about collagen, and then eventually link that back to the defect that Lingyan saw in the elaboration of the extracellular matrix. I'll show you first an experiment, then I'll tell you where they seem to be functionally linked. We have a cell line that prolifically secretes collagen. In fact, it's so prolific that it secretes procollagen that can't even be matured rapidly enough. And we found that in these cells, if you synchronize the production of and secretion of collagen using ascorbate, you have to add ascorbate to sustain a covalent modification of prolyl residues, prolyl hydroxylase action is required for the complete folding of procollagen in the ER. And if you withdraw ascorbate from cultured cells, procollagen piles up in the ER. If you then restore ascorbate to the growth medium, then you can synchronously secrete a bolus of collagen from cells. And if you do that, and you provide these cells by transient transfection under conditions where only maybe 40% of the cells are transfected, during a brief pulse with ascorbate, within 30 minutes, you can see, in this case, procollagen secreted into the growth medium. Very rapid, more rapid than these cells normally do once when you release this bolus of procollagen. In control transfected cells with an empty vector or with a mutant of this KLHL12 that Lingyan produced that fails to ubiquitinate SEC31, there is a little, if any, detectable procollagen in the growth medium during this 30-minute chase period. If you incubate longer, you can see collagen emerging, but it's clearly sped up by the expression, the overexpression of KLHL12. Lingyan then, once we made this connection to collagen, showed that if she adds the ES cell-specific form of collagen as part of the matrix on which ES cells are cultured, she could phenotypically suppress the absence of the CUL3 molecule. Recall, when you ablate CUL3 expression, the cells round up, they lose their undifferentiated state. That can be suppressed by simply providing on the matrix where these cells are growing collagen. That really nailed it, that collagen was the rate-limiting component that she had unwittingly stumbled into. So, of course, this all begs the question about what is it about ubiquitination that promotes this, what appears to be an altered scheme of polymerization by the outer layer of the COP2 coat. It's something that we're continuing to explore. But after we published our paper, we were still troubled by a small problem. That is, that we had not firmly established in this paper, in our paper on this subject, that collagen was contained within these giant structures. I mean, what I've said so far would lead you to believe that we had shown this, but we actually hadn't. And part of the problem, as we found in the last year, is that the antibody that we were using to decorate procollagen, intracellular reservoirs of procollagen, was not up to the task. And so we found, on close inspection, other antibodies that we now use, and which I'll briefly give you a sort of guided tour through, that are better at detecting intracellular deposits of procollagen. One of them is a commercial monoclonal antibody directed against a folded domain near the C-terminus of procollagen. And when we use that antibody in immunofluorescence labeling, we can see a number of punctine. These are cells that are not overexpressing KLHL12. We can see a number of puncti where the coat label, SEC31, aligns with the immunofluorescent labeling of procollagen. So we're now much more comfortable with this. And we've used this new antibody to explore in greater detail by confocal microscopy, but also, as you'll see in a moment, by super-resolution microscopy, the coincidence of procollagen with the COP2 coat in these cells, or in a cell that we've created for this purpose. So we want...
Should we think of the procollagen as being 300 nanometer objects like you showed on that, maybe it was the first slide? Is that the right dimension?
That's certainly the extended dimension of the rod. Whether it's rigid and cannot be deformed to be contained within a larger vesicle is a subject for some discussion. I'm not aware of the physical rigidity of the rod. My student was challenged on this point in a qualifying exam that she took. It may actually be somewhat flexible, but it doesn't become extended in the triple helical arrangement until prolyl hydroxylase acts in the ER. Before that, it really is relatively unstructured, but it then correspondingly can't be recognized to be packaged into a transport vesicle. Yes? Why don't you identify yourself? Who are you?
I'm Lavina.
Okay.
I wanted to know what is the size of these punctas which we are looking at.
Mm-hmm.
How different are these?
These puncta are about 200 nanometers in diameter, but they may be a little smaller. They're a little bigger than the puncta that one normally sees of SEC31 in a HeLa cell, and it may be a function of this particular cell line. No, not at this level of resolution. I think this is a confocal image. I don't think one could get that level of resolution on a smaller particle. But one could, as you'll see later on, using a storm microscope. Yes?
Is the interpretation from this micrograph, that all of the collagen is in this vesicle, or that some of it is?
Well, a lot of it in the background is still in the ER in these cells. These cells, as I said, are really prolific. They produce so much that there's a rate-limiting step in its egress from the ER. So, and these are not, these cells are, in this, for this experiment, there was no effort at synchrony. They're just growing normally. So collagen is, I think, probably largely still in the ER here. It may also have moved along to the Golgi apparatus. And it's only these relatively discrete puncti where one sees an alignment of SEC31 and procollagen staining. Okay. Yeah, sure, Gito.
In your previous experiment, what happens to secretion of regular collagen?
It's not affected at all. We've looked at fibronectin, and it's not blocked by ablation of Col3. And it seems to be normal. We didn't look at it in detail, but it seems to be normally expressed at the cell surface, even when you knock down Col3. So there may be other cargo molecules that are affected. We have not done a big survey, but we do know this in other experiments done by a different postdoc in the lab. We know that VLDL particles in a cell line that professionally makes these lipoproteins, VLDL secretion requires KLHL12. If you knock down KLHL12, those particles pile up in the ER. And again, VLDL particles are not giant, but they're a little bigger than normal COP2 vesicles. So I think that's consistent with big things requiring this. But whether other normal things do, that no one can say just yet. Okay, well, we wanted to look at this coincidence of collagen and the coat a little more closely. So we created a cell line, a derivative of a fibrosarcoma cell line, into which we introduced by stable transfection a copy of the collagen 1 gene. Ordinarily, these cells are not expressing collagen. But once they acquire the collagen 1 gene, the cells produce a lot of it. It's in the steady state. It piles up in the ER, and we can actually see, if you can see this image in the lower right-hand corner, by a pre-embedding labeling procedure, we can stain with our new monoclonal antibody procollagen in the lumen of the ER. These cells have also been stably transfected with a regulated copy of the ubiquitin ligase specificity subunit KLHL12. Under doxycycline control, and if you induce for just a few hours, you begin to see puncti of the of this KLHL-12. In this case, they're from 200 to 500 nanometers in diameter. And on further induction over the course of a day, these puncti grow to over 1 to 2 microns in diameter. So they're really big. Whether they're still functional at that point remains to be seen. So we did this because we wanted to be able to control the expression of KLHL-12. And so we've used this now to explore the coincident localization of COP2, of procollagen, of KLHL-12 in this fibrosarcoma cell line. I'll show you a few images of this sort. Here is a coincidence labeling of KLHL-12 and procollagen. The large puncti you see, the labels coincide. The background of procollagen probably is material that's still in the ER. We can even do triple immunofluorescent labeling. Here is such an image where we've used a flag tag KLHL-12 and a serum against SEC31 and the monoclonal antibody against procollagen. And these large puncti, again, align with nice coincidence of the all three labels. So these are probably not numerous structures. They probably are transient, because at a certain point, of course, the coat must be shed for the vesicle to progress and to deliver its content by fusion to the Golgi apparatus. So we may only be seeing a transient intermediate in this series of steps moving collagen out of the ER. Yes, Shelley. The more normal ones I showed you on this image. These are more typical. They're a little bigger than in a HeLa cell. These are these cells that are pumping out a lot of collagen. They're not tenfold bigger if you control the level of KLHL-12. By induction for just 7.5 hours. If you induce for 24 hours, you make these giant structures.
So there's not a structural limit that's being imposed on the coat? Because you have quite a large range.
But what we can't assess, unfortunately, is whether the giant structures that one sees after a long period of induction can go anywhere. They may be just dead end structures. That's sort of something that confounds our work. I'll tell you in a few minutes how we're proceeding to try to biochemically dissect this. Okay, so then we collaborated within the past year with a young faculty member in our chemistry department, a fellow by the name of Kai Zhu, who's built his own super-resolution microscope that allows imaging in a Z-stack and has allowed, he has developed this so that it can be used with multiple labels, so multiple independent immunofluorescence labeling of a Z-stack through, in our case, these giant puncti. So here is an image, a super-resolution image of this fibrosarcoma cell line induced for 7.5 hours. And here you see giant puncti where SEC31 and KLHL-12 align in a false color representation of a Z-stack through this puncta. One begins to have the feeling that there may be some hollow core to this large structure. Indeed, if you explore other examples in looking up and down through a Z-stack, you begin to see this hollow center with a coat surrounding it. In a structure, in this case, that's about 0.5 micron in diameter. And if you then do double immunofluorescence labeling on these puncta, you can see procollagen nicely tucked away in this interior of this cloud of coat. So we're now pretty comfortable that these coats really do accommodate procollagen. But it still remains open how this happens and how ubiquitination alters the polymerization of the coat. So let me just tell you briefly, without showing you any data, what we're doing to address this. So all of this work began with the development of a cell-free reaction that reproduces in vitro the production of COP2 vesicles, first in yeast, then in mammalian cells. It's really pretty simple to do this biochemically in my lab. But we struggled for years, until this past year, trying to accommodate the packaging of procollagen in membranes prepared from a cell line that's expressing a high level of collagen. So, and we finally succeeded through the efforts of a scholar visiting from Japan, Satoshi Baba, who found a way of lysing cells gently and of promoting the packaging of procollagen into COP2 vesicles that form in vitro. And he had to, since they're bigger than normal, he had to use different procedures to collect these vesicles than we normally use to collect the typically smaller vesicles. And he optimized this. And we now have quite reproducible packaging of procollagen. We can visualize in isolated vesicles using the antibodies that I've just described, large structures that are produced in the cell-free reaction where collagen is housed and the COP2 coat surrounds the vesicle. We even have been able to stimulate the packaging of procollagen by adding a recombinant form of KLHL12 to the cell-free reaction. So that, for me, is really the holy grail, being able to see something like this in a biochemically dissectable reaction. And so we're very hopeful now that we can get to the bottom of this by teasing apart the components and being able to mix them back together to reproduce this dependence on KLHL12, ultimately, to see how the coat is, the polymerization of the coat is altered. So I'm going to change gears, but let's stop to take questions. Yes? Yes, Boris. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm sorry, I don't have those images, but they're very, very recently we've been able to use this procedure to isolate the vesicles that are produced in vitro. And when we simply look at them by super-resolution microscopy, we can see large particles with coincident lipid labeling, COP2 labeling, and procollagen labeling. In the same field, we see many smaller vesicles that have the COP2 coat and lipid labeling, but with no procollagen. Yeah, we're just looking at that. We're just doing a size distribution analysis on the vesicles that we produce in this reaction. I can tell you, however, we published now 20 years ago when we produce COP2 vesicles with crude ER membrane fractions from yeast, and we just collect all the vesicles that are made with purified COP2 proteins, the uniformity in the distribution, size distribution, is stunning. There, we published it. An image now 20 years ago, a field of thousands of vesicles, just, you know, by collecting the high-speed pellet fraction from a budding reaction. And the uniformity is really quite striking. So normally, the coat has a preferred geometry of polymerization, at least on a native membrane. Now, if you do the same reaction with a synthetic membrane, an LUV, the coat will form flattened surfaces. It will bud vesicles of varying size. So it's capable of doing it all by itself. But when it's forced to work on a native membrane template, the uniformity, the intrinsic uniformity, is quite striking. So there must be extrinsic factors that alter that. Now, it's interesting to ask, what is it about collagen that could promote this alteration, because collagen, after all, is in the lumen of the ER, and the coat is assembling on the other side of the membrane. So there must be some intervening membrane protein that recognizes collagen and promotes this change on the cytoplasmic face of the membrane. One such a candidate for this is a protein discovered by Vivek Malhotra called Tango-1, which is a receptor for at least certain kinds of collagens. Collagen 7. Requires the Tango-1 receptor. It's a type 1, Tango is a type 1 membrane protein that has a C-terminus facing the lumen of the ER, where he's shown that it interacts with collagen 7. And an N-terminal domain on the cytoplasmic face that he's shown interacts with SEC23 and SEC24. So one idea is that a receptor like that may sense the presence of collagen, may change some, recruit somehow KLHL12 to the cytoplasmic surface, where it would then engage in ubiquitination of SEC31 and alter the somehow the rate of or the geometry of polymerization of the coat. Yeah, sure, absolutely. I mean, that would be a cool idea. But I think it would have to do it at least in part by interacting with a membrane receptor protein. So this is another general subject of some debate in the field, in this my particular field, and that is, do proteins leave the ER, or for that matter, any organelle, by just passive diffusion, or are they captured actively by interacting with a receptor molecule? There's a lot of evidence that favors different receptors that engage secretory proteins. But there is some other evidence suggesting that there may also be a process of bulk flow that can simply allow things that are not tied down to flow along the secretory pathway without being concentrated. So I feel collagen must invoke some kind of a receptor. But its rigidity may influence the polymerization of the coat on the other side. And you know, that's really a tough question to address. We're hopeful that this cell-free reaction that we have will allow us to explore that. Oh yeah, no, Tango 1's there. These are, the cell-free reaction is made from permeabilized cultured cells that are expressing Tango 1, endogenous Tango 1. Oh, absolutely, yeah. Yeah. We haven't shown, by the way, that Tango 1 is required in the cell-free reaction, but...
Okay, I was interpreting the cell-free reaction as being, you know, pure...
No. Because... So the way we do this is we take cultured cells and we expose them to digitonin, which binds sterols and selectively permeabilizes the plasma membrane. So you're left with a kind of a ghost, but with all the internal membranes intact. And then you can add to these ghosts, you know, purified COP2 proteins and other goodies, and it diffuses in and can bud vesicles. But it's doing so on a native membrane template, not a synthetic membrane. Yes.
Bill Rothman.
I know you. I've known you since you were a graduate student.
Yes. It seems like KLHL12. It's not just an enzyme going in there and ubiquitating, floating away.
No. It stays put. Yeah.
So mm-hmm. Is it actually forming?
Well, it's there, but it's being bound is not enough. It must also ubiquitinate. If you make a mutant that is catalytically inactive, you can still see the mutant protein bound to puncti, but it no longer promotes the rapid secretion of procollagen. So it has to be active in promoting ubiquitination. Yes, in the back. That's a good question. I don't know if I don't remember if we've if Lin Yuan is the group student who's done this. Do the small vesicles have KLH bound to them? I don't know. We could eat. That's an easy experiment. Good idea. Yes.
Wondering if there's any other indications of E3 ligases that might be acting on one or
class. Oh yeah, there are all kinds of other. Examples of ubiquitination of coats. I'm not aware of other examples of where there's been a functional implication of the ubiquitination. But the clathrin can be ubiquitinated. Adapter proteins can be ubiquitinated. The coat subunits that are involved in the invagination of membranes that bud into the interior of the endosome to make vesicles that are involved, that deliver things to the lysosome. Those subunits of the so-called escort complexes can themselves be ubiquitin. They bind ubiquitin. There are functional implications there. But I'm not aware of any other example where the ubiquitination has been directly linked to the polymer, to an alteration in the nature of the polymer, that's formed. But I bet there are other examples. But it's just no one's reported that I'm aware of. Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Don't know what the stoichiometry is of collagen within these giant vesicles. Are there multiple copies? Now that we can actually make these things in vitro and isolate them, I think those kinds of calculations are more accessible. Yeah. Yes,
you're not. I got a little bit lost with the relative sizes here. Can you remind us?
So these are half a micron in diameter.
So these are really large.
Yeah, really large. This is after 7.5 hours of induction, where the particle distribution, the larger particle distribution, ranges from 2 to 500 nanometers.
So that's quite a large collagen.
Yeah.
As well.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Shelley.
So now that you have this in vitro system, I just wonder if you have, or if you could ask questions about how generalizable this mechanism is to other.
Well, the other large cargo that we're looking at in the lab is our VLDL particles, which we can package also in vitro. We have the same kind of ability to package VLDL particles, and as I said, they are dependent. VLDL particle secretion is dependent or greatly stimulated by KLHL12. If you knock it down, they tend to accumulate. We have not reproduced that particular event in our cell-free reaction, other than the fact that we can get VLDL particles to be packaged. But that's now, I think it's going to be accessible. Yes? Yeah. I don't know. We do know this. I can't answer that for collagen, but we've looked at that kind of question before, and in yeast, and we can show that COP2 vesicles made in vitro have multiple independent cargo molecules contained within the same physical particle. We've done immunoprecipitation experiments where we precipitate with a tag on a membrane protein, and we can show that those vesicles can carry a soluble secretory protein in the same physical particle. So that general question has been addressed. Whether collagen excludes other things, we haven't done that kind of experiment. Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, they're all this is going on continuously. Things are leaving the ER, flowing out as they're made. The proteins take different lengths of time to fold properly to present, we believe, a sorting signal. So things that are made at the same time may leave at different rates depending on the rate of folding as a prelude to their being sorted into a vesicle. Yes? Yeah, my hunch is that in cells that are like these cells that are so prolific in secreting collagen, that there's the folding is completed, but that there's a limitation in the conveyance mechanism to get them out of the cell. And so if that's so, I would expect, but we haven't tested, that would affect the rate of secretion of other things that happen to be coming along for a ride. That these cells are just so prolific for collagen that will retard the secretion of other things. But we haven't tested that directly. How are we doing here? Yes, Rob.
For me and maybe students who aren't, you know, up on everything, could you maybe compare and contrast the what's known about clathrin with the COP1, COP2 situation?
Yeah.
Because every textbook says cells have three vesicle coat systems, clathrin, COP1, COP2. They're all sitting on clathrin, which is rather large.
Yeah.
And there's a little paragraph about COP1 and about the geometry in particular. And I could almost imagine with data of this quality, if you had many images like this, you could come figure out the geometry of these large
I'm sure.
Large codes.
I'm sure. In fact, we've done this. Julia Zanetti, who was a postdoc in my labs, now has her own lab in London, has done, and we published in eLife last year, a cryo-EM reconstruction of the structure of a COP2 coat on a synthetic membrane, not on a native membrane. So it is certainly accessible now to single particle, you know, reconstructions. So, I didn't have slides for this, but I can try to describe the differences. The coats are very different in structure and in polymerization. Clathrin comes in pieces. The heavy chain, light chain complex is a three-legged structure called that's been called a triskelion. It is recruited to a membrane through different pathways, but some invoke another GTP binding protein called ARF. And often clathrin invokes an adapter, one of several four or five different so-called AP complexes, 1 through 4, 1 through 5, that engage different cargo molecules. Now roughly analogous to the SEC23/24 mechanism that I've described for COP2. So that polymerizes, but the coat itself, the triskelion, assembles rather more intimately, forming a more rigid structure where the terminal legs of each triskelion intervene at the vertices of the structure to form a more significantly a thicker, more involved structure. And it's so involved as it polymerizes into a. There is evidence that. The coat can rearrange itself to form different facets. It goes from hexagonal facets to pentagonal facets, and there's some evidence for an HSP70-like molecule to withdraw the terminal leg in an ATP hydrolysis-dependent reaction to allow rearrangements to introduce pentagonal facets that that accommodate a change in the curvature of a structure.
Clathrin structures, this would imply kind of quantization in a sense, because you can only form a certain set of.
Oh, well, no, it's quite plastic in the sense that you can introduce different ratios of pentagons and hexagons into the structure, and the mix influences the final geometry of the structure. For COP2. We're less aware of what how that may be altered, but we know from the structure of the COP2 coat that it forms a rather more ephemeral structure, where the SEC31 WD40 domains at the N and C termini of SEC31 form have blades that intersect one another and allow the coat to form the shape, which is actually, as it was first described by Bill Balch, the polymer is a cube octahedron with squares and triangular facets. And although the structure of a graded series of these cube octahedrons of SEC31 has not been described, there is a precedent for this in a series of minerals that form cube octahedral structures of varying size, where you have different numbers of triangular and square facets. So, but that is the structure that forms seems to be a rather more ephemeral contact between this the C and N termini of Psych 31 and not this really overlapping alignment that one sees with clathrin. And so perhaps as a result, the COP2 code is more easily disassembled. It disassembles when SAR1 hydrolyzes GTP. SAR1, once it hydrolyzes GTP, retracts the N-terminal amphipathic domain. It simply diffuses away, and the rest of the coat that's there is now much less stable, and it can be spontaneously shed. It doesn't require ATP hydrolysis like the clathrin coat to shed a COP2 coat. Much less is known about COP1, actually. It also comes in, it's actually part of a 7 subunit complex that it seems to be relatively stable. It's recruited by a small GTP binding protein, ARF1. Its mechanism of depolymerization is less well understood. But it also it has intrinsic recognition of cargo molecules, in this case cargo molecules that are supposed to be retrogradely transported back in the secretory pathway. That's what COP1 does. But I would say it's less well explored than COP2 or clathrin at this point.
Thanks for that mini review.
Okay. All right, it's very mini. Yeah.
So this actually might be a good time for us to take the break.
Great, okay.
Thanks.
Very good.